The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Business of Sports.
The business of sports can be intimidating or hard for a startup to break into.
We really appreciate when our owners are actually there, you know, with us through the journey.
Teams, ours especially, have been very intentional to diversify at all levels of the company.
I think we're in the golden years for the NFL and college football.
Our demographic reach has continued to expand.
This is going to be really unlocking the streaming platform for sports fans.
Sports valuations are rising. We'll see when they peak.
You don't have to be the best in your sport to make a whole ton of money.
Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show where we explore some of the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr.
I'm Scarlett Fu.
And I'm Damian Sassauer.
Coming up on the show, we celebrate the start of the MLB season and dive into some of baseball's biggest headlines with MLB Network insider John Morosi.
The Dodgers didn't just lose in the playoffs last year and fall short of the World Series. They did not win a postseason game last year. So we're asking a team that did not even win a postseason game to sail right through and win the World Series. It's just not – it is not that likely, to be honest with you. They may have the best chance, but that chance is like – 25% and the rest of the field has 75%.
Plus, we'll take a glimpse at the latest episode of The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly. This week, we feature longtime sports anchor Hannah Storm.
But before we get there, we're still right in the middle of March Madness. We've already seen some big moments.
Williams to inbound. Simpson with it for the lead.
And we've still got a lot more action ahead before we crown this year's champions.
So no matter who ends up taking home the hardware on the court, the tournament's TV partners could end up being the biggest winners.
Mm-hmm. To help us dive into the numbers, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Media Analyst Geetha Raghunathan. Geetha, welcome back to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, right now, I'm sure the advertisers and the TV networks are happy because the ratings have been up slightly. But, you know, there's a lot of money to be made out there.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, this is a recurring theme that we see in media, Michael, because live sports does remain the most valuable asset on television. I mean, it is the crown jewel of media and advertising, especially right now when viewership is so, so fragmented. I mean, we just saw, you know, the Super Bowl. Obviously, that is the biggest event on television. You have 100 million viewers, but you do have advertisers paying about $7.5 million for a 30-second ad spot, and that's just a single event. You think about the March Madness, it's a much more kind of viable, a less costly alternative event that's kind of spread out over a much longer time frame, right? You have 3 weeks, you can reach a much larger number of viewers. And in many cases, you're reaching this young male demographic that advertisers really, really covet. So a lot of frequency, a lot of exposure to different audiences.
Yeah, advertisers like sports betting companies in particular, given how big a deal March Madness is for those who want to wager. Geetha, you published some research about the numbers when it comes to March Madness. The rights cost about $800 million to broadcast these games. How much are the different TV broadcasters making in terms of ad revenue and other kinds of revenue tied to airing these games?
Yeah, absolutely. So right now, I mean, the rights holders are Paramount's CBS broadcast network, and you also have Warner Brothers Discovery's Turner Networks. And together, those two companies pay about $800 million. That is actually going to go up slightly, actually not slightly, more than slightly, almost 37% starting in 2025 to almost $1.1 billion. As we kind of see it right now, these games are still profitable. And that's kind of a little bit unusual in the sports media landscape, because usually you have most of these companies paying huge amounts of money in terms of rights fees, and sometimes not really able to recover all of that even through advertising. But in the case of the NCAA, the March Madness tournament, it is very profitable actually for the media rights partners. We estimate that both Paramount and Warner Brothers Discovery this year will generate at least $1.1 billion in just advertising alone. So, you know, you compare that to the $800 million in fees. Yes, it is going to be profitable. Again, we don't know whether that's going to last, especially since the rights fees are going to go up and probably ratings. Yes, they've stayed fairly strong. They've held up pretty well. But who knows how it's going to shake out. But as it stands right now, yes, this is still a profitable tournament.
Pete, the live sports is certainly where it's at. You know, you were talking about rights here, and we can't ignore the elephant in the room, the NBA, the UFC. I mean, there are going to be some negotiations going on. Where are we in that process, and who exactly is involved?
Yeah, that's a great question, Damian. And, you know, it's a perfect time that you bring this up, because the NBA currently is actually negotiating with its current rights partners, which are, you know, Disney's ESPN, as well as the Turner Networks. So those two companies together are currently paying about $2.4 billion. The word on the street is that the NBA is seeking a massive, massive increase from 2.4 to anywhere to about maybe even as much as $7 or $7.5 billion per year.
Wow.
So a $75 billion deal, that is the rumored number. I'm not sure whether they're going to get it or not, but I think they will, because what we've seen this year is that this appetite for sports rights is only growing. And now it's not just the big media companies, it's also the big tech companies. I mean, we already know Amazon's made a big play for Thursday Night Football. They are supposed to be interested in the NBA. We know that Google has gone after, you know, again, Sunday Ticket with YouTube TV. And then, of course, the big one was Netflix, kind of coming out of nowhere there with that deal for WWE. And that kind of tells us that the sports rights market is definitely heating up again. April 22nd is the date when, this exclusive negotiating period between the NBA as well as Disney and Turner kind of comes to an end. And then it, you know, the NBA deals and the packages kind of go to the free market. And of course, as we just said, you know, Amazon, of course, is interested. There's also some word that, you know, NBC might be interested in a package for the Peacock streaming service. So, you know, as more and more streamers kind of get advertising, and of course Netflix is doing this, we know Amazon Prime has now made this big push into ad dollars as well, streaming companies are obviously looking to attract more and more advertisers, and I think they think that sports is a great way to do that.
You mentioned April 22nd as the day when the exclusive negotiating period ends. Is it pretty much a done deal that they're going to open it up to open bidding?
So what we've seen from a lot of the media companies is there has been a lot of cost discipline. Disney is kind of taking down its content costs. They were paying about $30 billion totally. That's not just sports. That's all content.
Mm-hmm.
This year, they're bringing it down to $25 billion. They are, you know, every company is really looking at cost rationalization, is looking at the bottom line, at improving profitability. But of course, sports has been kind of that one exception. But having said that, I mean, a lot of these companies have actually walked away from deals. We know Fox walked away from Thursday Night Football. They walked away from SmackDown. So they are kind of taking a hard look before they commit this huge sums of money. So to your point, Scarlett, I do think that, you know, many more bidders will enter, for the NBA packages.
Well, for the sports entities to ask for all this money, there's got to be a way to watch it. What brings us to cord cutting and live streaming? How is that going to impact how much can the NBA or MLB or whichever ask for the rights to broadcast?
Yeah, that's really a great question. And you know, we've seen the pay TV ecosystem lose about close to almost, I would say, 30 million subscribers from its peak. So we had about you know, 100 million pay TV households only about 8-9 years ago. Right now, we're down to about 70 million, and that's including even all of the streamers that have live TV packages like a YouTube TV or a Hulu live TV. So obviously, streaming is becoming a bigger and bigger part of the equation. You know, we have a lot of these companies who are now not just taking or not just putting games on their linear TV networks, but are also streaming them. And obviously, Peacock has been doing that along with all of the NBC sports. We're seeing Paramount do that, you know, with the Paramount Plus. And we've seen, you know, a lot of these streamers even have just streaming exclusives. And obviously, a big example there was, you know, the NFL wildcard game on NBC. And we know that the NFL is doing even more of that, you know, with Amazon broadcasting the next wildcard game in early 2025. So obviously, streaming is becoming a bigger and bigger part of it, which means that, you know, the streamers are willing to kind of shell out the big bucks. And again, we spoke about this a little bit earlier. You know, the big reason why they are willing to pay these huge sums of money for these sports rights is because that is one way they know they can really kind of supercharge their advertising tiers. And right now, everybody in the streaming world has an ad-supported tier, even, you know, Disney Plus and Netflix, who had kind of said that they were going to stay away from advertising, have advertising right now. And sports is a great way for them to kind of really accelerate the growth of their advertising revenue streams.
Well, Geetha, that's a great point. I mean, from what I hear, March Madness, I mean, this is going to be a record year. And certainly if you look at some of the numbers from the AGA, the American Gaming Association, in terms of sports gambling, I mean, it's just going to be a breakout year in terms of the amount of money people are wagering on this year's games. But, you know, you're right. To pay for these rights, Disney, I mean, you name it. These are not small amounts. So they obviously think they can pass those costs on to the advertisers. So talk to me. Who is advertising? Who's paying time slots? I mean, is it Nike, Puma? I mean, who's paying the advertising box?
Oh, it's everybody. I mean, you know, just a few years ago, we know AT&T was one of the biggest advertisers. You have Geico, you have all the, you know, these insurance companies. It's across the board. I mean, this is a great demographic that you can reach, you know, the 18 to 34 year old male, a very, very engaged demographic, a demographic that has pretty good spending power. And so, you know, you have advertisers all across the board. Of course, you have all the, you know, the athletic, the apparel manufacturers, retailers, you know, telecom companies, entertainment companies. Everybody is clamoring to get a piece of the action here.
FanDuel, MGM, DraftKings, Michael Barr, I'm looking at you.
Michael Barr, it's all insurance carriers. I mean, so, you know, you're in good hands there. I know, you know, in between games, you know, you love to shop, you know, for your insurance, right? And see how many, you know, how you can reduce your premiums. I mean, this is perfect for you.
Guess what day it is? No, I'm not going to bring that up. It's, but Geetha Raghunathan, you always lay some knowledge on us, and I always come away and learn a lot. Lot more when I listen to you. Geetha, our Bloomberg's very own intelligent senior media analyst. Thank you so much for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Thank you for having me.
Up next on the show, we turn from some of the NCAA tournament's big winners to the folks looking to win big on their March Madness bets. You're listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcast.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
This is the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr, along with Scarlett Fu and Damian Sess. Our March Madness is one of the biggest sports betting events of the year, and per capita wagers on the NCAA tournament are expected to be larger than this year's Super Bowl. Bloomberg opinion columnist Alison Schreger recently covered the growing impulse of Americans to place big bets on sports. She is here now to take us through it. Alison, welcome to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Thanks so much for having me. I never get to talk about March Madness, so I'm very excited for this.
I guess right now the biggest thing is advertisers are like, thank you, thank you, thank you. And then the TV companies are like, thank you, thank you, thank you, because everybody's making money. Ratings are up. Everything is good.
Yeah. I mean, it is this, when you try to explain it to people who don't live in America, no one believes me that, you know, the whole country comes together each year to watch college teams play. And, you know, I think it's special, one, because it's just always unpredictable. There's always these Cinderella stories. And also, unlike professional sports, you end up with these, like, teams in the middle of nowhere. Like, I'm from Storrs, Connecticut, this tiny town in the middle of nowhere, but we have this, like, enormous basketball dynasty. So, and it's an economically depressed community, too. So it really, like, brings people together. And traditionally, the other thing that brought people together was the brackets that, you know, sort of these low stakes gambling that you could sort of bet on with your colleagues and made it all a little bit more interesting.
Did you hear that? Low stakes gambling, folks. Low stakes. Don't go and get Benny the Bookie out there and then put $20,000 on a game. That's knucklehead.
You should not do that if you're Shohei Ohtani's interpreter, especially.
She went there.
you have to kind of throw that in there. So the interesting thing, of course, with betting and brackets when it comes to March Madness is that it's now like turbocharged because of legalized sports gambling. And you've written a column about this and how the excitement over brackets and placing bets with the March Madness brackets really highlights Americans' warped relationship with risk-taking. State your thesis for us.
Yeah, well, like you were just saying, don't bet $20,000 on Benny the Bookie. Well, like now you can do that on your phone instantaneously. And like, I was shocked to discover, because I don't really do sports gambling on apps, how large the bets you can actually put in a minute. And you can put it on a credit card. I mean, this is insane. And it just struck me as strange because, you know, I'm chronicling and I write a lot about how harder risk-taking has become in American society for a variety of both cultural and regulatory reasons. Things like moving, starting a business, even changing jobs have become a lot harder. Yet, we've completely turbocharged and enabled sports gambling. I mean, these are both risk-taking, but one is very sort of productive, grows the economy, makes you grow as a person. The other, like, I'm not quite sure. As I said, low-stakes gambling can be nice culturally and bring people together and make life more fun. But, like, enabling, like, or supercharging, you know, high-stakes sports gambling, I'm not quite sure that provides much value and, in fact, can be quite harmful.
Well, Alison, I really did appreciate what you said, or I guess the illusion that, you know, it shouldn't be easier for an American to buy a treasury bill than it is to place a wager on a, you know, a sports match, right? And I think that's a really interesting point because everything in our society, everything in our culture, and you point this out, is designed to kind of reduce risk here in the U.S. Yet sports gambling flies right in the face of that. So, you know, talk to us a little bit about that concept of safetyism. And more importantly, you know, what is sports gambling doing? I mean, some of your colleagues, Tim O'Brien, have talked about match fixing, not just in the U.S., but in other places. You know, I'm thinking cricket, I'm thinking snooker. Talk to us a little bit about how sports gambling is not just changing the U.S., but sort of the fabric of how, you know, different cultures kind of, you know, act in different countries.
Yeah, well, I mean, easy access to sports gambling is somewhat new in America because before 2018, it was only very specific places where you could bet, like Las Vegas. But after the Supreme Court decision, states were able to sort of have allow sports betting, and 30 states now allow on apps, which make it like very, very easy. So other countries have had more of a culture around sports gambling more. And I mean, one of the downsides has been, you know, it's easy to start getting into match fixing. And also, I mean, you also have more problem gamblers. I mean, if you make something easier, you know, you just get more problem behavior with it. Like, I like libertarian tendencies myself, so I'm not like, we should make it illegal. But I'm not, like, quite sure we should make it super easy either.
Hey, that's the problem, because I can just grab my phone, like I have every night, and and also it's a problem because it's too easy to get hooked. And I wonder now if, like, a Gambler's Anonymous or somebody like that, if they have spoken out about this problem.
I'm not sure about Gambler's Anonymous, but I did read quotes from other problem gambling communities that have said that they've seen a big uptick, and particularly a big uptick with young people, you know, who, you know, when you're younger, your brain is a little bit more open to risk, maybe it isn't making the same risk judgments. And what I find really disturbing is even these universities are promoting gambling to students, I mean, which is kind of outrageous.
Wait, pitch pennies.
Yeah, go back to that idea about universities pitching gambling to students, because you're not supposed to gamble until you're 18. So there are definitely some restrictions around that, but it's kind of like they're blanketing the airwaves with the possibility that you can put a wager, or you could do, what are those called? The parlays, right?
Yeah, the parlays.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in fact, I saw on Twitter someone complaining that they're in a state where they don't allow gambling apps, but they're still being advertised all over the March Madness, and they're starting, and like, there's messages like, ask your legislature to allow this too. Like, it just doesn't seem all that. I said, I'm someone who really is pushing the idea that we should take more risk, and, you know, we've become too risk averse as a society, but I didn't mean that.
Yeah, so the idea here that all these states are allowing sports betting is because they like the revenue. The revenue's great. It comes in, it's easy, and it's something they can count on.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a big reason it's taken off and why I don't anticipate any legislation on it that has teeth. I mean, there is talk about doing legislation about advertising, like maybe not having big sports celebrities pushing particularly. But I mean, come on, if it's, you know, you're not gambling on something because Charles Barkley has suggested to do it. I mean, if it's available, you're going to do it. I read somewhere that one possibility is that you could just make, you have to do sports gambling in person. That way you can't like be in the game and being like, all right, I'm going to set a new bet from my phone. That just make it a little harder. But as you point out, you know, states are really sort of liking that sweet tea of sports gambling revenue.
Yeah, and you can't put the genie back in the bottle, right?
Well, I mean, you could, but like they're not going to because they like the revenue.
Allison, you can hear it in Michael Barr's baritone voice that all he wants to do is talk about his brackets because he's doing so well this year. But let me also remind our audience that this year is all 1 and 2 seeds. So guys who took no risk in their brackets, no Cinderellas, are actually doing well this year for the first time in a while, hence Michael Barr. So talk to us a little bit about, you know, taking risk and sports gambling and what that's doing, I guess, to the fabric of society. I mean, are there more people out there who suffer from, you know, gambling addictions? I mean, are there statistics to prove that?
Yeah, I mean, I haven't seen like formal statistics, you know, collected by the government, but anecdotally, problem gambling groups have definitely said they've seen a big uptick in problem gamblers. And I said, particularly for younger people, which is concerning as they're starting out their financial lives, to say, you know, and it's not to say, because sports gambling, I guess, like day trading through apps has also become more easier. So we're not sort of like putting people on a path of, hey, this is a healthy risk to take, you know. No, like buy an S&P index fund or, you know, move cross country for a new job. But it's like, hey, you know, you can put $20,000 on your credit card and bet on a game. That seems pretty easy.
You see, Michael Barr, sports gambling is not a source of consistent income. Just, you know, reminding you.
Oh, OK. Thank you, man. I appreciate it. I think also is that, Damian, when we talk about gambling, and I try to tell this to my kids. It's like, look, you know, it's now, if you're going to bet, you know, bet coins, you know, this, okay, 25 cents, this and that, whatever. Because the moment you start going down that path of paper money, look out.
You know, for the big bets, like, don't do a bet that's not zero, that, you know, has expected value less than zero. But like, it can be fun to gamble a little, but know the limits.
Well, I think it's a good time to remind our audience of the Bloomberg brackets for charity, in which, yes, you know, Michael Barr, did you say you had an 89? Is that right?
86.
You just gave him 3 86. Extra points, Damian.
Okay, but I'll take the 3 extra.
Hold on for our audience. That would have placed Michael Barr in third place overall. And there are a lot of people involved here. But shout out to Peter Grauer, Bloomberg president. I mean, I'm board member. I mean, number 2, 87 points overall, right behind Bill McDermott of ServiceNow. And look, there are other people up there. David Solomon's in fourth place, CEO Goldman Sachs. I mean, Ken Griffin's up there in eighth place. Cliff Asness, you know, so you're up there with some rarefied company, Mr. Barr.
Well, I like to talk about me, but you can talk about me for a while. No, you know what? It is. We still have a long way to go. We'll see how this turns out. And Allison, this is a great article that you wrote, and I hope people check it out. March Madness shows confusion on risk taking. Allison Schrager, thank you so much for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports. We really do appreciate it.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
Our thanks to Bloomberg Opinion columnist Allison Schrager.
Find Allison's latest work and more with Bloomberg Opinion. You can check it out online at Bloomberg.com/opinion, or if you are on the Bloomberg terminal, type OPIN Go.
Up next on the show, we turn to baseball and the start of the MLB season with MLB Network insider John Morosi. But first, we give you a special glimpse at the latest episode of The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly.
That's right, Michael Barr. And this week features a longtime sports journalist, Hannah Storm. They talk with her about her childhood, watching ABA, that's the American Basketball Association, ABA games, the rise of the NBA, and of course, the future of sports storytelling.
Let's take a listen to a portion of their conversation about how she grew up all around sports.
I mean, to me, so I grew up not with an athlete. I grew up around all athletes around my house all the time, just giants. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I mean, they would be around the house. They would come see my dad or come for Thanksgiving or, you know, whatever it was, Christmas party. So I was always very comfortable around athletes. But I grew up on the business side.
Yeah.
Right. So I always understood how, devastating losing can be on that mm-hmm. level, the criticism that you take, mm-hmm. On that level. I guess in a way, it's given me a really global perspective on sports, which honestly, the average probably commentator doesn't really have.
That's Hannah Storm on the latest episode of The Deal with Alex Rodriguez and Jason Kelly.
You can watch it on Fridays at 7 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Television. You can also stream it on Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Originals. And don't forget to check out the podcast. It's available on demand wherever you get your podcasts.
Up next, Play Ball! We celebrate the start of the MLB season. You're listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio.
Thanks for joining us on the Bloomberg Business of Sports show, where we explore the big money issues in the world of sports. I'm Michael Barr, along with Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer. The MLB season is officially underway, and here to talk us through some of the sport's biggest headlines heading into another season is MLB Network's John Morosi. John, welcome back to the Bloomberg Business of Sports.
Michael, Scarlett, Damian, happy opening day this week. I know that no shortage of topics for us to discuss in the great game of baseball right now.
Well, first off, let's start. Shohei Ohtani, he gave a news conference, didn't take any questions, but he said, hey, I was ripped off by what was supposed to be my best friend and interpreter, and he took money from me as he was paying off his gambling debts. Your thoughts about this?
Well, first and foremost, we're a long way away from getting the full and final picture of this. As it's been reported, there are now multiple investigations happening. There was the initial inquiry that the federal government's looking into the alleged illegal bookmaker. That's one. The second investigation, of course, is that which has been requested by Ohtani's camp. It would appear into the what they've alleged is a massive theft. And then the third investigation is the one that MLB is looking into. So you've got three different investigations happening. There certainly are some relationships among the three that could influence the other. But I think where this all stands at the moment is Ohtani's going to keep playing. There is at this juncture, there is no evidence that any of the wagering was on baseball. And that, as we know, is would be the major, major concern. And there, it appears that that has not happened in this case. And so at this juncture, based on past precedent and the way that MLB has handled circumstances of this kind in the past, it appears that Ohtani is going to continue playing and that he is not going to be placed on administrative leave, and that we're going to keep seeing him play. Now, how does he play? How does he handle playing in hostile environments on the road where fans might be reacting to him in a more negative way than he's ever seen before, all against the backdrop of historically aggressive spending by the Dodgers and these expectations that are extraordinary? Those are all open questions as well.
So that's interesting that you said hostile road games. Do you think it'll be hostile? Because if he's not at fault here, and that's what he's saying, he's been kind of the moneymaker for teams when he goes on the road. You know, you have the fans cheering for him just showing up and seeing what he can do with his bat. Will this dampen, does this change the reception that he gets, not just in LA, but across the nation?
You know, Scarlett, it's a great question. I think that at home, the response will still be very favorable. And that's the one thing that I believe Dodger fans have been, from what I can read on this, fairly supportive and very much behind Shohei. Obviously, he's played only two regular season games for the franchise to this point in time, but it does appear that their loyalty and support for him is remaining strong. But to the point about being on the road, and obviously there's two separate considerations there. One is the fact that the road ballparks and the road teams, you're right, they will love that when he shows up, it's going to fill their stadiums and there's going to be a lot of people who are curious to see him play. But I almost compare him in some ways to when LeBron joined the Heat and the way in which they became the story that we talked about in the NBA for several years. But they were not universally loved by fans on the road. They were an easy team to dislike. And I think when you look at it in a vacuum, even setting aside, even before the Ipe Mizuhara story came up, I was thinking to myself that especially when he goes into the ballparks in San Diego and San Francisco, because those are two places that don't like the Dodgers to begin
right.
with.
They're all about Shohei beat LA.
Exactly. So Shohei has now joined a team that even apart from this controversy is one that among other teams in the division are not favorably received. Whereas the Angels, when you think about it, for all the superstars they've had, the Angels are not exactly a hated behemoth in the game of baseball.
They're not the evil empire.
Right, exactly. They're not the Yankees. They're not the Red Sox. They're not the Dodgers. And so I think that whenever you sign a record contract with a big money team and you join with a couple other former MVPs in Freeman and Betts, you're going to invite a lot of criticism. So I really think that even before this whole story unfolded, that Shohei was going to have an experience unlike any that he's had in his career, which is potentially being booed or jeered on the road. Mm. Because think about it. Last year, Scarlett, yeah. there were a lot of fan bases that were being very kind to him. Seattle was one that I would mention because they thought they had a chance to sign him. So they were being almost overly kind and gracious towards him because he wanted to yep. say, wow, what nice fans they are there. I want to sign with that team this offseason.
Well, JP, I'll tell you, one thing about all this Shohei Ohtani thing. I mean, Vegas loves this, man. The sports books love it. I'm looking at Mookie Betts, Freddie Freeman. They were both predicted to win the NL. They were higher odds to win the NL MVP before Shohei Ohtani. Now Ohtani's bumped up ahead of them, right? So the controversy seems to be good, and it looks like Vegas thinks that Shohei's going to be able to contend with it pretty well. But, you know, you were there, man. You were in South Korea. You know, you saw them play the Padres. Talk to us about this year's Los Angeles Dodgers. Are they really the odds-on favorite to win the World Series?
Well, it's interesting. I do think that they are the most talented team. But I would also say this, and this is a very good point.
Plus 350.
Well, here's the thing. Bill Shakin wrote recently in the LA Times, and I think it's a very important insight, that they're probably not going to win the World Series. They're probably not. Because when you look at the way that the baseball playoff structure is set up, with the short series to begin with, the layoff before the top seeds end up playing, it's not exactly set up for the top seeds to be protected. It's interesting that you mentioned that I was just in Korea. Amazing experience. Here's how the Korean playoffs work. This is fascinating, by the way. The team that has the best record gets an automatic bye to the Korea series. Automatically.
Oh, I like that.
So think about it. So basically, I believe it's the top seed gets an automatic bye, and then the subsequent division, the subsequent teams just have like a continual ladder playoff all the way to the end. So like the fourth and fifth seeds will play. Okay, the winner of that plays the third seed. The winner of that series plays the two seed, and then eventually they play.
I guess the argument against that is divisions, right? I mean, you have certain divisions that are weaker and stronger than others,
correct.
And so you can't really, yeah, you know.
Yes, I'm using a very extreme example, but the point there is the baseball playoffs are designed to have maximum competition and to honestly expose your top division teams to a real challenge early on in the postseason. And the way that it's set up, and Bill made this point in the LA Times recently, that over the last 10 years, there were as many wild card teams who became World Series champions as teams that had the best record that became World Series champions. It affirms that once you get to the playoffs, it's all a very random and exciting playoff. And we have to remember this, that with most of the same players, obviously Ohtani has now joined and Yamamoto has joined and Glasnow has joined, but with a lot of the same players, the Dodgers didn't just lose in the playoffs last year and fall short of the World Series. They did not win a postseason game last year. So we're asking a team that did not even win a postseason game to sail right through and win the World Series. It is not that likely, to be honest with you. They may have the best chance, but that chance is like 25% and the rest of the field has 75%.
Well, JP, I mean, look, we could spend all day talking about the Dodgers, but who cares, right? I mean, we care about the Yankees and the Mets. And the Tigers, sorry. So listen, I look at the
They'll be better. They'll be better, Michael, I promise.
Yeah, buddy.
They're going
to be better. So I look at these teams. I look at like some of these core major media markets, and their teams are nowhere to be found near the top. I mean, the Yankees are the closest you're going to find. I think Vegas has them as like the 4 or 5 seed, you know, to win it all. But, you know, then I look at AL MVP, and I look at Juan Soto. And I look at Aaron Judge, and they're right at the top there. I mean, does that two-headed monster get it done this season? Or with all these injuries, I even think, didn't DJ LeMay, I think he's injured now.
Yes.
I mean, what is going on with the Yankees and the Mets and the Red Sox and maybe the Tigers
right.
also?
No, well, you're fair. And so here's the thing about the Yankees. I think they're going to be good this year. And I'm concerned about LeMayhew, as you mentioned. But I look at the way that the Yankees are set up with Soto and Judge together, and I believe that is going to be one of the most dynamic duos we have ever seen in a Yankee uniform. I believe this team finds a way to win the division, that Soto's going to bring out the best in Judge and vice versa. Would not surprise me at all if one of them ends up being the MVP in the American League. So I'm on the Yankees. As far as the Mets, I agree that we're not expecting nearly as much from them as we were a year ago. I do like the signing they made of J.D. Martinez, but this is not their year to compete, in my opinion, especially with the Kodai Senga injury to begin the season. I believe the Braves and the Phillies are the class of the National League East. As for the Red Sox, you're right. They really have gone off the map in terms of being a team that we talk about a lot. They just haven't invested in the roster as much as they have in the past. So they're going to be a team that I think is somewhere in the middle to the bottom of the American League East. But I do expect the Yankees to be a very, very prominent team. And then I think out West, we have a chance for some pretty interesting stories. I think the Padres in the NL West are better than people realize. I think the Giants are better than people realize. In the American League West, I like the Seattle Mariners. I realize they just got some tough injury news with Brian Wu, but I like their rotation overall. Mm-hmm. Julio Rodriguez, one of the more talented players in the game. So I look at the Mariners as being another team that we maybe look at and focus on as a possible postseason contender again this season.
John Morosi with the MLB Network. I love you, man! Thank you, buddy.
Likewise to all of you, and Michael, we will see you in Detroit for the postseason this year, my friend.
Yeah, buddy, I got my 20 ready. Special thanks to MLB Network insider John Morosi for joining us. Now, if you missed any part of that conversation, find it on demand now on the Bloomberg Business of Sports podcast. Find it on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports show. We are here each and every week at the same time. For my colleagues Scarlett Fu and Damian Sassauer, I'm Michael Barr. Tune in again next week for the latest on the stories moving big old money in the world of sports. You're listening to the Bloomberg Business of Sports from Bloomberg Radio around the world.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox president Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.